Thanks to those who have come from so far away for this one-day workshop, which I hope to be an exciting discussion of the recent results announced by BICEP 2 of the detection of B-mode polarization of the CMB. I think we're all very enthusiastic. We're all excited to know what this means, how this can inform us as we go forward and think about cosmology. So we prepared a day-long set of talks, a panel discussion, and so I hope you enjoy it. The only two announcements I have, at 1:30 there will be an important announcement in the atrium. I will leave it a mystery so that you can come, but there will be a very exciting announcement that is about some of your colleagues, so please come and join us at 1:30 for a short announcement in the atrium. And then lunch will be in the bistro upstairs. So after the second morning session, you can just make your way up there. We are starting with two talks, and then we'll have a coffee break. We'll come back for a panel discussion, and then we'll do lunch. So without further ado, I'll turn it over to Kurt Hinterbickler, who will chair the first session.
So the first talk is by our very own Kendrick Smith, who will give us an introductory entitled B-modes.
All right, good morning, everyone. It's really exciting to be talking about this. I think the whole community is in a state of post-B-mode brainstorming and absorbing the implications of these results. In the 30 years since inflation has been proposed, we've had a ton of time to think about all possible branches of models for the early universe, and we're suddenly in a state of trimming a lot of the branches, and this measurement has had surprising implications in a lot of different ways. So my talk is basically mostly for non-cosmologists or maybe for people that don't think about this every day. I'm just going to give an introduction to what BICEP has measured, what some of the implications are, to set the stage for Chris Sheehy's talk, who is a member of the BICEP 2 collaboration and is going to talk about. We're going to get the introduction out of the way so we can talk about hardcore data analysis. Okay, so BICEP 2 has detected cosmological B-modes. If we agree that a few loopholes have been closed, foregrounds and systematics, of course, and this workshop is in large part to discuss the loopholes, but if we ignore these loopholes, then another statement we can make is that inflation is the correct model of the early universe. That's a very exciting statement to be able to make. That statement has its loopholes too, which I haven't tried to list exhaustively. If we ignore those, then we can make the statement that inflation took place at an energy scale around the gut scale close to M Planck and involved field excursions of order M Planck, provided that other loopholes are closed. There's a lot of, the punchline of this is kind of rich, contains loopholes, and is not 100% crisp. One explanation is that BICEP 2 has detected gravity B-modes generated quantum mechanically during large field inflation. And this is a really amazing observation. I mean, it's the most interesting observation in cosmology in, say, 20 years. I find it really inspiring that inflation, a theory which was originally proposed with almost no observational clues and just based on general arguments, made this really specific prediction, thereby being testable, which was observed. That's a really amazing tour de force for theoretical physics. It's amazing that we can observe physics at energies near the Planck scale, maybe not see that physics in action, but observe its fossil remnants. Because the physics takes place close to the Planck scale, this is a quantum gravitational effect. We're measuring something having to do with quantum gravity. I guess that's the first time we've been able to say that. It would be an overstatement to say that this measurement probes quantum gravity in detail. The semi-classical quantum gravity is good enough to make a complete set of predictions, but it's still, you know, a consequence of the energy scale being close to M Planck, where quantum gravity matters. Totally amazing. Now I'm going to sort of back up and talk about the picture, the cosmological picture prior to this measurement and what was measured. So before BICEP 2, we were living in a cosmological model with six parameters. Three parameters describing a curvature-free non-zero cosmological constant expansion history. So those parameters can be the fraction of the energy density today in baryonic matter, in cold dark matter, and the Hubble constant today. The initial conditions within all the observations were Gaussian, scalar, adiabatic power law initial conditions. Those four adjectives taken together means that the initial conditions are completely described by the adiabatic curvature zeta, which is a Gaussian field with a nearly scale invariant power spectrum, but slightly non-scale invariant. There's this small power law dependence. Finally, there's a nuisance parameter we always have to throw in, which is the optical depth to recombination, which dims the CMB. The philosophy, this model has held up for a long time. And so for a while, cosmology has kind of been running with the philosophy that we're going to parameterize enumerate and parameterize all interesting deviations from this model and do experiments that shrink the error bars on those parameters. And so for a long time, you know, we've all been giving talks where we make statements such as the bottom one in the slide here, where we just, you know, list a checklist of things that we're looking for and then report the latest null results. So 2 weeks ago, BICEP announced the detection of one such deviation from the six-parameter model. We now need a seventh parameter, which parameterizes the amplitude of the primordial gravity wave background, the tensor-scalar ratio R. So the initial conditions now consist of two Gaussian fields, the scalar adiabatic curvature zeta, and a traceless tensor gravity wave background, which it's conventional to let R be the ratio between the amplitudes at an arbitrarily chosen scale. These are both power laws. We've measured NS pretty well, but there's not much we can say about NT. I'll come back to this later. So to put those initial conditions in context, I just want to, for a few slides, talk about inflation. And I'm only going to talk about the simplest model of inflation, which is consistent with BICEP's observation, namely slow-roll single-field inflation. So imagine that the universe starts at a very high energy density because a field phi is high up on its potential, and the universe undergoes nearly exponential expansion as this field phi slowly rolls down its potential. The nearly flatness quantitatively means that the slow roll parameters, the so-called slow roll parameters epsilon and eta, defined in the slide, these definitions I'll use all over the place, are both much less than one. If that flatness condition is satisfied, then inflation is a nearly exponential expansion that generates the initial conditions with the correct statistical properties. So as inflation progresses, all fields, in this case, those fields would be the metric and the inflaton phi, are quantum mechanically excited and end inflation as Gaussian random fields. The observables that I defined in a previous slide, the amplitude of the scalar power spectrum delta zeta, the tilt of the scalar power spectrum NS, and the tensor scalar ratio R, are related to the potential by these simple formulas. Prior to BICEP 2, we hadn't measured R. We hadn't detected R being statistically significant from zero. And so we had two measurements. Great, thanks. So without the R measurements, you can see that the observables here depend on three parameters, the energy scale of inflation, H, there's two slow roll parameters, epsilon and eta, so we had two measurements in a three-parameter space. Now that we've measured R, and if we interpret that measurement in the context of single-field slow roll inflation, then everything is pinned down. With these numbers, which come from, well, either WMAP or Planck, BICEP 2, you can compute in this model, you can compute everything. You can compute the energy scale of inflation, which is close to M Planck. You can convert the measurements of epsilon and eta to the values of the first two derivatives of the potential at the point When the inflaton was at the time when the modes corresponding to our C and B scales were generated, a nice way of interpreting the epsilon constraint due to David Lith is to convert it to a field excursion per E-folding. This value of epsilon means that in each E-folding of inflation, the field value of the inflaton changes by about 0.06 of an M Planck, so that over the course of 60 E-foldings or so of inflation, the inflaton traverses a few M Plancks in field space. Okay, so the point of the slide really is that with this new measurement, everything is pinned down. We know that that inflation happened at energies near the gut scale. We know that Planckian field excursions were involved. Here's what we actually measure. As everyone here probably knows, the CMB is linearly polarized and contains no circularly polarized component. Linear polarization can furthermore be broken down into E and B modes. That's a non-local decomposition, which is similar to the gradient curl decomposition of a vector field. Here we have a traceless symmetric tensor in linear polarization, and so it's defined a little bit differently. The significance of this decomposition is that there's a little theorem that says that if you only have scalar perturbations in the initial conditions, and linear theory is adequately accurate, then no B modes are generated. And this theorem is really just parity invariance. I mean, just for fun, we can state the proof. In linear perturbation theory, we can just pretend that the initial conditions consist of one Fourier mode. A single Fourier mode of a scalar field has two symmetries, rotation symmetry around the k-axis and a parrot reflection symmetry in a plane containing k. And that combination of symmetries is enough to guarantee that the polarization is a pure E mode. There's simply no B mode invariant under those symmetries, no B mode on the sky. When we measure the CMB, we measure a map of temperature and polarization. We decompose it into T, E, and B. And then we compute power spectra, which are statistical measures of the size, the squared amplitude, of T, of E, and B, and we also compute the cross power spectrum between T and E. TB and EB are zero in a universe where physics is parity invariant, and so I haven't included them on the slide. The point of this slide, I didn't put the current measurements on this slide yet. Roughly the situation is that TT is measured extremely well by WMAP Planck and ACT SPT, many experiments. TE and EE have been measured on the order of tens of sigmas by WMAP in small patches by ground-based polarization experiments like BICEP, and will soon be measured much better with Planck in, let's say, order 6 months. BB is, of course, the exciting measurement made by BICEP. What I wanted to illustrate in this slide really is two things. One is that as we go through the panels, you can see the y-axis getting, the range on the y-axis getting much smaller. Temperature is a huge signal in comparison to B. I mean, it's about five orders of the B modes are about five orders of magnitude down in power. So this is an extremely challenging measurement and a real hardware tour de force. The other thing to notice is that it's hard to tell the difference between an R equals 0 model and an R equals 0.2 model without measuring the B mode. Due to the theorem mentioned on the previous slide, R makes a big difference in BB. The black curve here, the R equals 0 contribution to BB, only comes from second order effects, the largest of which is gravitational lensing. And so the B mode, the tensor B mode, can look quite large in contrast. So prior to BICEP 2, constraints on R came from the temperature power spectrum. Turning R up to 0.2 makes a 5 to 10% difference, adds power at low L in the temperature power spectrum by about 5 or 10%. You can see that the measurements actually show a deficit of power in this L range. So the measurements were actually already kind of borderline inconsistent with an R equals zero model. And so adding a large tensor signal makes them more inconsistent. And so temperature prefers a low R value. We get tight upper limits from temperature. The Planck plus WP, WP stands for WMAP polarization, which has to be added to current Planck data, which is temperature only. This will change when very soon when Planck polarization data comes out. In the Planck paper, the upper limit, R less than 0.11 and 95% confidence is quoted. Interesting to ask how consistent, that naively is inconsistent with the BICEP result. It's interesting to ask, study that in a little more detail, and I'll talk about that shortly. Here's the BICEP 2 measurement. They report measurements, they measure TE and B, report measurements of all power spectra, but of course the most exciting plot is this one in the lower left. The curve on top is the sum of the R equals 0 gravitational lensing signal and an R equals 0.2 tensor mode signal. And they see this bump at low L corresponding to a gravity wave amplitude of around 0.2. The blue curves here are jackknife tests. I'll tell you what those are in a bit. Those are supposed to be consistent to zero, consistent with zero power for an ideal instrument. So I want to talk briefly about systematics and foregrounds, because I think this is really the heart of the analysis, and just showing a plot like this would really be incomplete without some discussion. I just can't morally bring myself to do that. Wasn't sure how much information to say, because really Chris's talk is largely going to be a systematics and foregrounds talk. So I decided to draw the following line. I'm just going to make general statements about systematics and foregrounds, and I'll leave it to Chris to talk specifically about what's going on in the BICEP experiment. So I'm just going to show a few slides to orient you to the world of CMB systematics and foregrounds. So here's a plot that will make life seem scary. So instrumental effects, the instrumental effects that you really have to fight against when doing this type of analysis are those that convert the temperature or E-mode anisotropy into B-modes. If you plot TT, EE, and BB on the same axis, TT is about 5 orders of magnitude up in power from BB. Just to flesh this out with an example of how you can mix this huge 10 to the 5 signal and contaminate B, here's a little cartoon of a polarization-sensitive bolometer. Imagine that you have two little wires, one of which averages the square of the x component of the electric field, and the other averages the square of the y component. Then you integrate for a while and subtract those measurements to measure one component of the linear polarization. But if that subtraction is ideal, you'll cancel the temperature. But you can get an imperfect cancellation if the two pieces of wire, if you don't know the correct relative calibration, this effect is called differential gain. If the two pieces of wire don't have exactly the same effective beam on the sky, then when you difference, you'll leak the temperature convolved with the difference beam. Or if the pointing is slightly different, if the two pieces of wire don't point in exactly the same place, you'll pick up the dipole of a dipole in the temperature. This effect is called differential pointing. There are other effects that leak E into B. There are many of these effects. I'm just giving sort of the spirit of it. I actually did this for my PhD thesis. I wrote a pipeline for an experiment called CatMap. So I can tell you from anyone who's done this knows that the reason this analysis takes so long is that characterizing and projecting out the systematics is just a big war fought with the tools of linear algebra and 80-hour work weeks, and this is really, really the heart of the BICEP analysis. One more general comment, something that's very powerful in telling you whether you've corrected systematics are jackknives, also known as null tests, which are constructed in the following way. So first you choose some interesting split of the data into uncorrelated subsets. You could take the first half of the data set in time and the second half. Make a map from each of those subsets. When you get these two maps, M1 and M2, if you were to average those two maps, you would now have the cumulative map for the experiment that the bottom line power spectra come from. But you can do something different. You can difference the two maps. And if all of your systematic characterization is perfect, then the CMB signal in temperature E and B will perfectly cancel out, leaving you with a map of pure instrumental noise. And you can test that hypothesis by computing the power spectrum of the null map and making sure that the power spectrum, you know, with error bars is consistent with zero power. In the bicep table, they have a big list of system of jackknife tests. And so if you have a instrumental systematic that you're worried about, say differential pointing, then you may be able to convince yourself using this table that they've characterized it properly. You know, if differential pointing was a problem, that should show up in this test called deck jackknife, where you split the data based on the orientation of the instrument when the sky was observed. So if you were picking up, imagine that you divide the data into two halves where the whole instrument is rotated by 90 degrees. Then if you had a little dipole, if you were leaking the dipole of the temperature into polarization due to differential pointing, then the two splits would see a differently oriented dipole. And so when you subtract them, you'll bring out that you'll bring out that mismatch, and you'll see power in the jackknife test. That's all I have to say about systematics. Next, I'm going to show a few slides on foregrounds. So another thing that's going on in these measurements is that we don't get a perfectly clean measurement of the CMB. There are other astrophysical sources of emission at CMB frequencies. So the two that are most important for BICEP are polarized synchrotron radiation from high-energy electrons accelerating, you know, undergoing synchrotron circulation in the magnetic field of our galaxy. So synchrotron radiation can be highly polarized perpendicular to the magnetic field. In practice, it tends to average down due to a line of sight containing many magnetic field orientations. And then there's thermal dust emission. Dust grains, for surprisingly complicated reasons, tend to line up with the galactic field, the galactic magnetic field, which leads to polarization perpendicular to the magnetic field, just like synchrotron. But the polarization fraction tends to be less in dust than synchrotron. I should mention that BICEP observes foregrounds are kind of large on the full sky, but BICEP observes in a very small 1% patch of sky, chosen to sort of peek out through the structure of the galaxy and minimize these foregrounds. So the best way to separate the foregrounds from CMB is to make measurements at multiple frequencies. The CMB is a black body. I've plotted, as a function of frequency here, Rayleigh-Jeans temperature, so that the CMB blackbody is a slowly decreasing curve. Synchrotron tends to fall off in these units as roughly frequency to the minus 3. Dust tends to increase as frequency squared. So if you have many frequencies, you can try to take linear combinations to pick out the CMB component against these foregrounds. BICEP 2 is only observes at 150 gigahertz, where dust is expected to be polarized dust is expected to be larger than synchrotron. There is also 100 gigahertz data in the same patch taken at BICEP 1 with higher noise. The BICEP 2 collaboration also has 100 gigahertz data at lower noise from Keck, but that hasn't been analyzed yet. WMAP on this chart would have a bunch of frequency bands down here. Those are very helpful for characterizing synchrotron. Planck has a range of frequencies, but hasn't publicized going out to the highest polarized channel in Planck is at 353 gigahertz, but hasn't publicized polarization maps yet. So I want to just give a couple of slides to give you sort of a mental image of these foregrounds. So synchrotron emission can be mapped and characterized at low frequencies, and it's very well measured and characterized. One thing that's found is that the spectrum is harder, meaning that it goes out, the frequency dependence is flatter, it contains more high-energy photons, near the galactic center. And so an interesting observation, I'm still talking about unpolarized synchrotron, is that you can fit for the total synchrotron emission as a sum of two components with a soft and a hard frequency dependence. When this is done, there's this WMAP haze. The hard synchrotron shows up near the galactic center. It's, of course, a very interesting question whether this has something to do with dark matter annihilation, but sort of tangential to Bicep 2 talk. Polarized synchrotron, the best measurements that are relevant for Bicep come from the WMAP 23 gigahertz data. The polarization fraction ranges between about 5% in the galactic plane to about 30% at its certain regions at high galactic latitude. There is no evidence for the hard synchrotron component in polarization, although this map is noisier than the temperature measurement, so it's possible that it's there at some sub-dominant level. I personally find it kind of unlikely. It is important for the Bicep analysis to know whether hard synchrotron exists in the Bicep patch, which is sort of down here. I personally find it unlikely that polarized hard synchrotron would show up in the Bicep field, since in temperature, it's only near the galactic center, and there's no evidence for it in polarization at all. But that's just my personal take on it. It's also very helpful for the Bicep analysis to have WMAP measurements of the polarized synchrotron map near the Bicep, in the Bicep patch, so that you can cross-correlate and see if it's showing up at Bicep frequencies. The dust foreground's a bit trickier. So the unpolarized...
They said now apparently they're in bubbles, and the bubbles go farther off the plane. So I don't know, those bubbles could extend to...
Oh, this slide is from Planck?
Well,
is that what you're asking?
I'm saying the people who invented haze, now they say they're not... if you trace the boundaries, there are so bubbles that go above and below the plane.
Well, I know that there are Fermi bubbles. If you look for gamma ray in it,
yeah.
And it goes up a little higher. This plot is the result of fitting for a soft plus hard, fitting Planck data to a soft plus hard
okay.
model.
Mm-hmm.
So this should give a fair indication of what's happening at CMB frequencies.
Okay, good. And where is the Bicep patch there?
The Bicep patch, there's no public footprint. But it's roughly, they do.
There is no public footprint.
They do show, so I couldn't actually put it on the plot, but it's sort of down in this dark, yeah.
I see. Okay.
Okay. This is the lowest, 23 gigahertz is the lowest. 23 gigahertz is the lowest frequency of W.
From its
From the various channels, can't WMAP measure the spectral index?
Yes.
They can measure the spectral index. Okay.
Yeah, it's hard to tell what's going on in the Bicep 2 field from WMAP because it's so clean. But if you look at the whole sky, WMAP is consistent with a soft synchrotron spectrum over the whole sky with no real evidence for hard synchrotron anywhere in polarization. Okay, dust. If you're asking questions about unpolarized dust, then you're in great shape. It's really important in many sub-branches of astronomy, and it's been modeled to death. I mean, you can download code where you type in a frequency and a location on the sky, and it will tell you exactly what level of dust emission you should expect at that frequency and sky location. Polarized dust emission is trickier. So WMAP measures it. WMAP's highest frequency channel is 94 gigahertz, showing, you know, about 5%, say, polarization fraction in the whole sky with a polarization direction which traces the galactic magnetic field and sort of resembles the synchrotron polarization direction. But one cannot really make statements from WMAP about what's going on in the Bicep 2 patch because WMAP's just way noisier. It's a way noisier instrument, and Bicep 2 is at higher frequency where the dust is brighter. So if you want to make a guess for what polarized dust is doing in the Bicep patch, you can take the unpolarized dust maps, which are very well understood, and then combine them, do some modeling, combine them with a model for what the galactic magnetic field is doing in the Bicep patch. This will change when Planck releases 353 gigahertz polarization maps later this year. And there's one other thing. Well, it's sort of an interesting world in that in the rush to have Planck polarization maps. It's been noticed that the Planck collaboration gave a talk where they showed these maps of polarization fraction and polarized dust direction. And if you combine these numbers with the polarized dust intensity, then you have everything. And so one can digitize these maps and use this, just literally use the pictures in the slide as if they were data. And that is one thing that is done in the BICEP 2 paper, although that's clearly more of a check than a definitive statement. But I'll let Chris talk about that. But this is fun. Okay, so that's all I have to say about systematics and foregrounds. And I'm going to talk about some of the implications of this measurement. What time is it? How am I doing on time? Okay, great. Okay, so let's ask the question, how much tension is there between the Planck upper limit on R and the BICEP 2 measurement of R? If you plot likelihoods in the usual way, then you would conclude, I think, that the tension is not that bad and could easily, it's not too much of a stretch to imagine that it's a statistical fluke. If you continue these likelihoods to negative R, the preceding plot is what's usually shown for the R likelihood of Planck. If you continue the likelihood, if you formally continue it to negative R, then you see that what's actually happened is that Planck has a big power deficit on large scales that's showing up here as a negative value of R. And when you chop it off, when you chop off the negative part and then blow up this tail to make it the whole likelihood, things are seeming less tense than they really are. So I'm going to argue that this plot is showing the true significance of the tension between the two experiments. So negative, just to make it explicit, negative R, of course, doesn't make sense physically, but it's just a way of parameterizing the temperature power spectrum without making an a posteriori choice, like zeroing in on an L band where you noticed ahead of time that the Planck power spectrum was low. You're L weighting in the shape of the R derivative to avoid making a posteriori choices. Well, if you ask the question how, if we're asking the question in the first place, somehow I knew you were going to complain about this. Sorry. I don't know how, but I was expecting. I understand your point, but I do think it's a valid question to ask. If you truncate the likelihood at R equals zero, then essentially what you're saying is that any power deficit I see beyond an R equals zero model, I just have predetermined to be a statistical fluke. I'm just going to throw away that part of the likelihood. So if continuing the R likelihood to negative R, the issue of whether to do that is the question of whether you're going to count, whether you're going to allow the deficit relative to an R equals zero model to contribute to the tension with an R equals 0.2 model. Now it seems to me that this is a fair thing to do. If to take just to exaggerate, if we imagine that the measurements came out 10 sigma below the curve, then we would certainly say that there was tension. Well, then there would be tension with R equals zero, not just with R equals 2. The tension shown in this plot, in my view, is a fair measure of how statistically significant this power deficit is, how much harder it is to explain away it's a statistical fluke when you raise the power spectrum by 10% by putting in R equals 0.2. But I do want to make the assumptions transparent, so I suppose everyone in the audience can decide for themselves whether they think this is the fair plot or this is the fair plot. In the first one, the tension that you would infer is a few percent, which is, I think, not really that big of a deal. In this plot, the tension is around 0.1%, which seems sort of worth investigating. I would also argue that if you search for models that relieve this tension, for example, running, then you see preference for a non-fiducial value at around 3 sigma, which is another way of arguing that the true tension is more like 3 sigma.
B-mode amplitude, right?
Yes.
If you are letting R to be negative, it's just contribution to TT to go negative, then why do we have any relation between the amplitude of B-mode and the contribution to TT in the first place? If you're breaking the physical...
I'm just trying to avoid making an a posteriori choice. Like, if I chose this L bin, if I said, let's look at L equals 25, which is... If you make that a posteriori choice, this is already almost 3 sigma low in power.
No, I agree. What you are measuring from TT and the plot for Planck, it's a fair point to let it go negative, just a parameterization of this contribution. But then I don't see how this has anything to do with the bicep measurement.
Oh, yeah, so the red curve, I guess you don't have to just... I didn't let it go to negative R. It wouldn't really make sense to extend the red curve to negative R. Yeah. At any rate, it's so low there that it wouldn't matter. Okay. This can be debated. I tried to make the assumptions transparent, but I would argue that the tension here is around 3 sigma, if you take everything at face value, which is not large enough to draw any conclusion, but I think large enough just to play around with, since we're all in this mode of post-bicep 2 brainstorming. So one observation one can make is that E-mode polarization is really powerful for telling you whether this tension is cosmological or a statistical fluke. An R equals 0.2 gravity wave background changes EE. There's a range of multipoles where the change in EE is around 30% as opposed to around 10% in TT. And so the statistical error on R, when E-mode measurements are included, shown here as a function of the noise level, can get, even with sort of, you know, even with Planck, which is sort of here, E-mode polarization helps a lot. So that'll narrow and shift this likelihood. And so if it shifts over to be in agreement with the red curve, then we'll find that the discrepancy has gone away. But it could also become, if it becomes more significant, we'll know that there was something cosmological going on. Another thing that's sort of fun is to do sort of a brute force search for cosmological parameters which can explain the Planck temperature discrepancy. So we did this highly sophisticated procedure where we ran CosmoMC, marginalizing every parameter that CosmoMC lets you add to the 7-parameter model. And just identified parameters that would explain the discrepancy, you know, just to get an idea for what the sorts of things that one has to do. So an example that was pointed out in the Bicep 2 paper is you can introduce scalar running, which is a scale dependence of the scalar power spectrum of this form. This is motivated in slow roll inflation. This is the first sub-leading correction to the power law. The coefficient here in slow roll inflation would depend on the third derivative of the potential. In the Bicep 2 paper, it's pointed out that if you marginalize running and Planck, this is a plot from the Planck paper. This is Planck data alone. R can be as large as 0.2. If you put in the numbers, the best fit running is negative at about 3 sigma, negative a few times 10 to the minus 2, which is larger than what slow roll would predict by a factor of 100. So roughly speaking, one has to do some sort of funny business with the potential, tune things at the 1% level, but it can be accommodated in slow roll single field inflation. One thing we checked here is that there's a bispectrum signal. If the running is large, there's a V triple prime term in the bispectrum, but we checked that is too small to be detected. A value of running this large would also have implications for direct gravity wave experiments, as I'll say in a minute. Another thing that I'll mention for completeness, I mean, I find this to be in a pretty weird model-building territory, is if you let the tensor power spectrum have a very blue tilt. So Planck measures tensors at L equals 35. Bicep measures them at L equals 60. So if I let the tensors grow very rapidly with scale, grow by order 1 in an e-folding, then that would bring the two measurements into agreement. If you just brute force run CosmoMC, then you find that a blue tilt of order 1 is preferred at more than 3 sigma. In single field slow roll, NT is always negative. That's because the amplitude of the power spectrum is basically H squared, and H dot is always negative in single field inflation. Well, once you're on the slow roll attractor anyway, that's true. Just for fun, we computed how blue the tensor power spectrum could be before we run into constraints from things like primordial black holes or BBN. And the answer, roughly, when you work out the upper limits, is that if you average NT over many E-foldings, it has to be lower than 0.4. Yes?
Are going to weaken by a good deal, because if you only have constraints on R at one scale, then NT is allowed to vary completely, unless it bumps into the constraints at small scales, like you said. So I was wondering, if you don't use the small scale constraints, maybe that 1.27 will become even larger.
I'm just making the point that if you just extrapolated a power law this large all the way to the end of inflation, you would run into problems with BBN or produce primordial black holes.
Okay.
So it would have to roll off.
All right. Okay.
Okay. So I don't really know what to make of this, but just mentioning it for completeness. Finally, a really interesting possibility. This is not my paper, so I'm just like throwing slides from this. But putting a slide from this paper into the talk purely because I think it's interesting. Another parameter that our brute force search flagged was the effective number of neutrino species. This was explored by these authors in a paper that came out on Monday, which in post-bicep 2 time is ancient. So if you introduce an extra neutrino species and make it a sterile neutrino with a mass around 0.5 eV, then that reconciles both the Planck bicep 2 degeneracy. You can, you know, arrange to have this suppress the scalar power spec. After tracing through a chain of other parameter degeneracies, arrange to have it suppress the scalar power spectrum on large scales. And it also, interestingly, resolves the apparent tension between Planck's inferred measurement of the Hubble constant and direct measurements. If this is the correct explanation, then the preferred value of NS is actually 1, and M squared phi squared would be disfavored. A lot of this is driven, this analysis includes constraints from cluster counts, and so the extent to which this is driven by cluster counts is not clear to me. Those have their own systematics.
Mass of a sterile neutrino fixes the cluster count, and the numbers fixes the the bicep stuff. So that there's essentially no degeneracy or very little degeneracy between these two, it seems. I mean, as you can see, right?
Oh, I see. You're saying the cluster counts are really just constraining. Like
yeah, it's just the vertical one is the cluster count, the horizontal one is bicep / Planck. Yeah.
Oh, okay, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's talk about the future. So in the near future, I predict a big race to confirm this bump. Let me say that just my personal opinion is that this measurement, I suspect that this measurement will hold up. The thing that I find convincing, if I can go back, I don't claim that my opinion is any more authoritative than anyone else's, but I find the measurement of this bump shape to be pretty convincing. If it were, it's hard to imagine foregrounds and systematics conspiring to produce this bump. One could speculate, for example, that this bump out here is due to leakage from the temperature power spectrum, due to leakage from T. That's just a guess, since it's at the same multipole as the first temperature acoustic peak. But there's no, if you look at the other power spectra, if you look at temperature and E, there's nothing at this scale, nothing that would produce a bump at this scale that I can see through instrumental effects. foregrounds, residual foregrounds, are likely to produce a power spectrum which rises, slowly rises in these units at low L. And also, I don't really, it seems like a stretch to me to have them produce the bump shape. Nevertheless, I think the, you know, the proper perspective given a measurement like this is to, you know, regard it as preliminary until another experiment confirms it. So there are many experiments. The climate is such that there were many experiments that were all sort of designed for a world where bicep 2 didn't see anything and everyone was racing to measure r equals 10 to the minus 2. So now these experiments are kind of over specced for, this would be a 20 sigma signal. It, you know, it should just be a big thing that's, that pops out, I guess, if you can beat the foregrounds. We'll have a panel discussion where some of the experimenters talk about this, but we're going to see either confirmation of this result or you know, some modification of it very, very soon. As I've argued, E-mode polarizations may also be interesting if they turn out to sharpen the Planck bicep 2 discrepancy. Longer term, we can think about characterizing, now that we've measured R, we can think about measuring NT and characterizing scale dependence of the tensor power spectrum. If you just measure B modes, if you have an ideal measurement of the B modes, the cosmic variance limit is around 0.03. You can't see the gravity wave B mode on small scales because it starts to get swamped by lensing. There's a sort of a natural target for NT is the value of NT that's predicted by the single field consistency relation. And in single field Sorolle inflation, NT and R are both proportional to epsilon. So there's this relation between them that predicts that we should see if bicep 2 holds up. There should be a minus sign here. A negative NT at around 2 times 10 to the minus 2. right. right. yeah, this this discussion will definitely be influenced by how that gets resolved. A fun thing to forecast, there are statistical algorithms called delensing that can statistically separate lensed B modes, which are non-Gaussian, from tensor B modes, which are Gaussian, and reduce the effective level of lensing contamination. So for a fiducial set of specs, 1 microcharac/minute and a noise in a 2 arc/minute beam, you can reduce, delensing algorithms can reduce the effective noise level from the blue curve to the green curve in this plot, letting you go further on NT. Here's a plot showing the statistical error on NT. With delensing, by the way, you're required to measure the large Ls, the small scales, even if you're only interested in delensing large scales. Here's a forecast showing without delensing, the blue curve, the statistical error on NT as you lower the noise saturates at a cosmic variance limit. But with delensing, just keeps going. There's no cosmic variance limit. You can just keep reducing the lensing. You can get out, if you can get down to around 0.1 microk arc minutes on F sky of order 1, you can perhaps verify the consistency relation at a few sigma. This is very futuristic. This would require something like 10 to the 6 detectors. But experiments with those specs have been discussed in the literature. So this is maybe kind of an ultimate finish line, being able to verify the consistency relation, sort of an ultimate finish line for CMB polarization. Even more futuristic, I think it's really fun in this context, now that cosmological gravity waves have been detected, at least there's been a preliminary detection, to think about this direct gravity wave experiment on solar system scales called BBO. BBO stands for Big Bang Observer. So for purposes of cosmology, this experiment can be regarded as just measuring one number, omega gravity wave, on solar system scales, which probes the tensor power spectrum on a much smaller scale than the CMB. And this number is an interesting complement to the CMB observables. So given a slow roll potential, you can integrate down. You can integrate from CMB scales down to BBO scales to compute the gravity wave amplitude that BBO should see. And there's also sort of a perturbation theory expansion that one can do that relates, if you expand the tensor power spectrum out in powers of log k, And then use consistency relations to relate those coefficients to the CMB observables. Then you get a fairly good extrapolation if you can measure R and S and the scalar running from CMB scales to BBO scales. So here are some things that one could do with BBO. If you have a specific model that you believe, say M squared, phi squared, then the CMB, in a futuristic CMB scenario, you can verify the predictions of that model to, say, a few percent. You'll have an error ellipse in the R and S plane, which is very small in R, a few percent wide in NS, and then you'll have a curve going through corresponding to the derivatives of M squared, phi squared evaluated at different values of phi. So you really get one measurement from the CMB that's good to a few percent. If you have this specific model, imagine that we find consistency with M squared, phi squared, and so we say, oh, aha, we have this simple potential must be the answer. Then that makes a prediction on BBO scales, a sharp prediction that can be measured to about 3%. So you would get a second check. Another scenario one can consider is where the Planck bicep 2 tension holds up, and we're left wondering whether large running is the explanation. That explanation could conceivably hold up to futuristic CMB experiments. Then BBO can provide a second measurement of running over a much larger range of scales that would tell you whether that hypothesis is correct. And finally, if we're talking about testing the single field consistency relation, like I was saying from the CMB, BBO is incredibly powerful. It can do this at 20 sigma. And so it can tell the difference between single field inflation and, say, models with multiple fields or models where something else is going on. So this one number, omega gravity wave KBBO, interpreted in the context of different sets of assumptions, is quite an interesting complement to the CMB observables. That's all I have to say. My conclusions are on the slide. Thanks for listening.
Any questions? We'll be running around with microphones, so please wait for it so we can record the questions.
So I was just wondering why you highlighted the neutrinos and the running rather than something much simpler, which is like a break in the power spectrum on large scales, because the running is a bit of an overkill and it doesn't fit the data that well. And neutrinos, as you mentioned, that you sort of have to go from one completely different scale where you're seeing this to, and then jump through parameter degeneracies to finally get the effect you want, which is to change the large scales there. So what do you think about?
Absolutely. I mean, that's a completely viable fair explanation. If you had some sort of feature in VFI, near the scales where Planck and Bicep measured the tensor power spectrum, I imagine. Well, you've written a paper on this, so you that's certainly an observationally viable scenario. Yeah, that's a completely fair comment. I mean, that should certainly be included in the list of candidate explanations.
So even going beyond the previous question, so if you look at alternative models to inflation, generically you find that the gravitational waves on super Hubble scales grow at the same rate as the scalar perturbations. So I would actually claim that in most alternative models to inflation, you will generically get a larger value of R than in small field inflation models. So I think these models should actually be tested against the data in the same way that now single field inflation models are being tested against the data.
Let's talk about that after the talk. Sounds interesting.
Sorry, this is a really remedial question, but when you say that WMAP, for example, has measured properties of the dust through its polarization, how do you know that? Is it empirical? Is it there's a theory of the dust that you match? Can you say a little bit more about that?
That's a good question. I mean, what's directly measured by WMAP are just maps of the linear polarization at five frequencies. And then those are fit pretty well by a three-component model where they're just consisting of a soft synchrotron, a black body, and just a Rayleigh jeans dust nu squared. I mean, you would see if you had like blobs of dust with a low enough temperature, then you would start to see corrections to the nu squared because you'd be out of the Rayleigh jeans regime. That doesn't really. If you go out to like Planck frequencies, you can see that, for example, at Planck 857 gigahertz, you can start to see the roll off. But there's no evidence for it in WMAP.
Can I comment the sort of recognizing that's done in the WMAP maps or the Planck maps doesn't require deep understanding of dust. It's smaller than a wavelength, so its radiative efficiency is lambda squared more or less. So it's a little more complicated than that, but it's the thing which is a rising power law in frequency. And so what you mean by dust is objects which are smaller than a wavelength?
Yeah. A model-independent statement one can make is that the WMAP polarization is fit by a sum of, you know, frequency to the minus 3, frequency squared, and black body terms, the first two of which are interpreted as soft synchrotron and dust.
Let me try and challenge you a little bit as to why you believe the experiment is right.
Okay, great.
You said because there's a bump. Isn't a bump a completely generic consequence of having a signal which, let's say, rises with L, and then I do some kind of subtraction to clean out part of it that would produce a bump? So I'm not quite sure why just seeing a bump persuades you that the effect is real. If there was some contamination which produced a rising signal in L, and then I did something in the experiment to clean away the high L, which they do, why does that persuade you?
What sort of high L cleaning?
Pardon?
What sort of high L cleaning do you mean?
Well, the experiment, you know, let's look at the experiment. So it has its error bars rise. The bicep 2 points rise at higher L, right?
Yes.
In this data.
I mean, what?
Sure.
Yeah, okay.
2 points. One, can we quote you that bicep plus Planck has ruled out inflation at 3 sigma? Because that's what you said. Inconsistency relation is ruled out at 3 sigma, right?
I think that there's a tension between...
It's a 3 sigma tension, isn't it?
Planck and bicep 2 that I would argue is 3 sigma.
The tilt, that I'm talking about the tilt.
Yeah. If you interpret that tension as tilt... then you would conclude that inflation is ruled out at 3 sigma.
Okay, good.
But I'll leave it to you to assign the probability. That's the correct interpretation.
Good. And the second point is that couldn't you just draw a straight line across those first 4 points? A horizontal line.
I'm not taking the position that I'm a hardcore defender of bicep 2. I'm just sort of expressing my belief that it's more likely than not that this experiment will hold up. This measurement.
But I'm just saying I don't see a bump there. It's just that because of the curve you see a bump. But if you put the curve there, it's just a straight line. I mean, it's the first 4 points that you think is gravitational waves are just a straight line.
If you wanted to fit this to residual foregrounds, then you'd want to put in something that was a little bit redder than constant, like L to the minus 0.6 is roughly what's seen.
Is that right?
And so this would, and so that would not be a particularly good fit, although this point, the error bars are sort of large from sample variance, and I haven't computed, say, a number of sigmas. I mean, it would be interesting to fit these points to the sum of a fixed gravitational lensing, a gravity wave bump with arbitrary amplitude, and then an L to the minus 0.6 foreground contribution with arbitrary amplitude and just see at how many sigmas you're really telling the difference between a bump shape and a power law shape.
Thank you.
It looks like a bump to me.
Okay, if there's no more questions, let's thank Kendrick again.